We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions. Hello and welcome to the Rock Art Podcast, episode 32, with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm Chris Webster, and today I talked to Dr. Garfinkel about Nummik scratched rock art. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. This is Chris Webster, and I am joining you, which usually means that we don't have a guest, which is good because this time around, when we don't have guests, we get to have a little rock art clinic with Dr. Alan Garfinkel. Alan, how's it going?
Chris Webster, it's always an honor to connect with you and to take a riff and, you know, plan on sort of taking a deep dive on various sundry subjects in the world of rock art. Don't you agree?
I do indeed. So in the past, on some of our episodes where we've talked about various styles of rock art and different techniques and stuff like that, the phrase Nummik scratched has come up, or scratch style rock art. And today we're going to focus solely on Nummik scratched. And I think before we really dive into Nummik scratched and gender and some other concepts that we're going to handle today, let's talk about those two words that I just said. First, what is Nummik? And then we'll talk about what scratched means, just so we can walk that back. So what is Nummik first? Let's start with that.
So those people, the anthropologists, and a specialization within anthropology, of course, is called linguistics, the study of languages worldwide. Mm-hmm. These linguists like to classify languages, and they try to develop ways of describing those languages and developing a bit of a typology. And that typology helps them to understand or reconstruct the history of prehistoric population movements and the antiquity of certain languages, how they developed, where they developed, what particular groups are affiliated or connected in part of this broad mm-hmm. structure. So one of the largest linguistic groups in the Americas is an entity called Uto-Aztecan. And Uto-Aztecan, as you might surmise from its name, includes the Utes, or the native indigenous people from Utah. And it also includes those in Mesoamerica, in Mexico, called Aztecs. And they all spoke a related language, a linguistic stock or large mega family called Uto-Aztecan. It's one of the biggest linguistic classifications, language classifications, certainly in California. It covers most of the Great Basin. Hopi is a linguistic isolate in the American Southwest. And then when you go to Mexico, many different languages, including Aztec and Huichol, are Uto-Aztecan. And within Uto-Aztecan, within the Great Basin of the far west, the desert west, as it were, and in California, there are sub branches of Udo-Aztecan, and one is Numic, another is Tokic. Numic is the predominant language, the linguistic family, that covers the entire Great Basin. The Great Basin is Eastern California, Nevada, Utah, parts of Arizona, even into Colorado, etc. And this was a very large linguistic grouping that was only represented by three different languages per se. So we have an enormous area in the far west that is called Numic or Numic. The word Numic or Numic actually is just a, you know, sort of a takeoff on the word for person in classification of languages, which was Nuwu or Numa or Newi, all kinds of words that are like that. It means person in those languages.
Okay.
So that's what Numic or Numic means.
I'm wondering if the, just back to languages real quick, would the Udo-Aztecan speaking people, you know, I understand there's a bunch of languages in that overall broad family.
Yeah.
Were they close enough that people would have understood each other? You know, maybe not spoken the same language, but at least kind of understood each other, like dialects of Spanish and dialects of like Chinese.
They would have noticed that there was a relationships. But as the geographic distance increases, sometimes the languages change sufficiently so that they are not mutually intelligible. But that being said, the people that lived along the Colorado in California and then spanning the entire California desert into the Tehachapi Mountains all spoke a single Numic language called Southern Paiute, and they were mutually intelligible. And so the Southern Paiutes go all the way into Utah and Arizona, et cetera, Nevada. So all of the above. So there is this larger entity that shows a great geographical expanse with mutual intelligibility. Does that help you?
Yeah, I think so. That's good. I was wondering about that. I'm always curious about linguistics and language and how those things work. I mean, language helps frame how your brain works, right? How your brain is organized and how you think is largely related to the complexity and type and style of your language. I mean, that's pretty pretty common thing in linguistics, which helps us interpret rock art, I would say. Yeah.
Right. As we think and as we speak and based on our vocabulary or our inventory of words, they are certainly an inference, a way of inferring the nature of our cosmology, meaning our worldview, our perceptions of the cosmos and the world. So we try to use those words as a means of almost reconstructing or deconstructing the lifestyles and life ways of people, but also identifying their affinity for one another, their connections with one another, and what they felt was most important. How's that?
I like it. Sounds good. So what is scratched?
Scratch is just simply a way of describing this kind of very ephemeral, meaning not very distinctive and not very easily identified. So this ephemeral rock art, this scratching, is very superficial. It's easily obscured. It's easily ignored. And in fact, what happens is we didn't really know about it until relatively recently.
Okay.
It scratched.
Yeah.
They used a piece of stone, a conchoidally fractured stone, a piece of obsidian or chalcedony or agate or other sorts of tool stone. And they simply scratched a design on the rocks. And the reason I've been so obsessed and interested in it is it appears to be a rather late expression of rock art. At one point, we thought it was a way of sort of obliterating the older rock art styles.
Mm-hmm.
And then we determined that that may not be the case. And it may just be a means of embellishing that kinds of rock art, or actually bringing more power to it, or recognizing or revering it in some way. So we've got a number of different takes on this Numic style of rock art.
So how do we call this nummick scratched. I've never heard of any other type. Now, this is my ignorance too, but I've never heard of any other rock art being described as nummick this or anything else that. Why are we ascribing nummick to this scratched style of rock art and not just calling it scratched?
Some rock art researchers believe that there is an ethnic affiliation with this style of rock art. They believe that this specific rock art is specifically associated with the Great Basin people, the foragers, the hunter-gatherers that lived in the Great Basin, the Desert West, and then that they were the ones during the late prehistoric times to fashion this rock art, because it's found in its greatest preponderance and in the greatest amounts in sites that would have been occupied historically by Nummik people.
Okay.
So I didn't come up with it. It was actually, I think, done by Polly Schaffsma, or it's another woman rock art scholar that's done a lot of work in the Kosos. And and she also uses this name very commonly. Also, Joanne Van Tilburg, who did the work at Little Lake, used this terminology as well. So it's gotten a lot of airplay, but it's certainly not without controversy. Some rock art scholars believe that we shouldn't call scratched rock art Nummik scratched.
Right.
Scratched rock art is all over the world. The Nummik people were only one group, and other people in other areas scratched rock art as well.
Okay.
But there it is anyways.
Yeah, there it is. So.
So anyways, as the youngsters say, it's a thing. Right? The millennials
nice,
say
nice.
It's a thing. It's a thing, right?
That's right. That's right. So I think in the second segment, we mentioned right at the beginning here, we're going to talk about some gender studies related to this Nummik scratched rock art. But I think in the end of this segment, let's do a little bit more description, because you mentioned it's literally scratched, you know, with a rock on a lot of times on top of other rock art, and a lot of times really lightly scratched. But can you describe a little better what one might see when they're looking at this? To use your words, paint us a word picture about what Nummik scratched would look like.
Nummik scratched is mainly a rectilinear and abstract mode of embellishing rock art. You'll see it in association with other rock art frequently.
Mm-hmm.
It will be lightly scratched, thinly scratched. It'll be rectilinear lines. It's a lattice work. You'll see maybe some curvilinear elements, wavy lines, but it seems as though the patterns emphasize this intricate, almost intersecting set of lines that occur as diagonals, as triangles, as almost basketry patterns, it looks like. And that's what they were doing. It looks like they were embellishing or defacing other rock art, or it's on canvases, rock canvases, that don't have any rock art.
Hmm.
It's almost always abstract and non-representational, but I'll talk about that as well, because there is representational rock art that is scratched that does seem to fit with this particular style, but it right. hasn't really been reported yet. How's that?
Yeah, that sounds good.
I'm not keeping it a secret, though.
That's right. I think some of the Nummik scratched I've seen, you can see how it was misinterpreted for graffiti, because it looked like somebody literally took a rock and tried
like
to scratch out what was
below
it.
Took a rock and just scratched out. It looked like it was trying to deface it.
Yeah.
The people that studied rock art in the 1960s and early 1970s, as an example, throughout the Great Basin, didn't even recognize that there was this Nummik scratched rock art or Great Basin scratched rock art.
Right.
It wasn't ignoring it. They didn't see it. So it's not easily seen. If you go to rock art sites and looking for Nummik scratched, if it's a nice, clear, sunny day, you're not going to see any of it. It's only seen normally when it's a cloudy day, or when the sun is sort of, the light is sort of glancing over the rock canvases, And then it pops, absolutely pops. Mm. You can see it everywhere.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about gender with this style of rock art. Back in a minute. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on, and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code ROCKART. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 32 of the Rock Art Podcast. And we are talking with Dr. Alan Garfinkel about Nummik scratched rock art. And Alan, when I type in Nummik scratched into Google search engine, the first article that comes up is by, I don't know, some guy named Alan Garfinkel, PhD, with a Kish LaPierre, LaPierre, called Are Nummik Scratched Rock Art Drawings Women's Work? First result in Google, by the way. So good job for that.
First result in
Google. So that's surprising. What do you mean by that? Yeah, what do you mean by that? Why would you think this is the result of women's work?
Well, Kish LaPierre was a pioneer in sort of recognizing this, as was Joanne Van Tilburg and Amy Gilreath as the other researcher. And if you notice, they're all women, and they're deciding, you know, why couldn't this be women's rock art? Well, the basis for that assumption or assertion is that, first of all, when you look for Nummik rock art, this Nummik scratched, if you want to find it, you go to areas where women want to do their work. In other words, if we have a milling site, if we have somewhere where they would process plant foods, or where they would collect plant foods near, let's say, a lake or a spring, guess what? There's Nummik scratched rock art. Also, that Nummik scratched rock art often embellishes areas around those features. So they're found on milling slicks, little bedrock milling basins. They're found in association embellishing or surrounding bedrock mortars. So those are interesting elements to consider. When a detailed review of Little Lake out there in the Western Great Basin, the southern end of the Owens Valley, was done by Joanne Van Tilburg, she found that an unbelievable amount of rock art was in fact Nummik scratched. I think it was over 25% of the images, the elements that she found consisted of the scratching. She felt that it was actually related to pottery or production or the gathering up of some of the plants that occur on the margins of the lake, because those were considered to be, they were the cattails or the sedges, and they're very nutritious and important plants, important economic plants. What Van Tilburg said was, we suggest that females, some of whom were probably doctors, participated in activities that produced rock art. And they all, she also said there are tantalizing hints that some of the motifs are associated with or reflect intimate events in the lives of girls and women. Isn't that a epiphany, that we could have rock art that is actually fashioned by women?
Yeah, that's crazy. It's awesome how we can kind of infer that through other evidence. I like it.
And there's other evidence besides that. The rock art itself is light. It's not heavy. It's not deeply etched. It's very superficial. It's almost invisible, as I said, unless you see it at the right time of day. And actually, in certain areas, the subject matter, when in fact it is representational, which it rarely is, features mm-hmm. images that would be associated with women, such as baskets. So in Little Petroglyph Canyon, there are depictions of baskets done using this technique. It intimately connects with this subject matter.
Here's a question for you, because, and not that we're comparing these two, but a lot of times when we're talking about activities that women did and activities that men did, mm-hmm. a lot of times children, of course, associated yes. or stayed with yes. the women, especially younger children. So how do we know this wasn't done by children?
We really don't. And I think that's a great working hypothesis. It could have often been done by children, both little boys and little girls. Initially, what the publication said about this kind of rock art was that the intruders, the Nummik, as they're called, may have been attempting to obliterate or somehow, you know, erase or eradicate the older rock art. But as we began to know more and more about it, we don't believe that anymore. We, at least most of us, do not. It seems mm-hmm. that this rock art was not meant to obliterate, but embellish, enhance, or somehow capture the power from the former imagery and contribute right. additional strength to, let's say, an older drawing.
Yeah, because when we look at this as it can look like graffiti, that's putting our modern bias on what graffiti looks like, right? On what something damaging looks like. But to the mind of somebody who was living in that time period, it could have been looked at as an embellishment. I'm wondering how you and other researchers came to that conclusion, because when I look at this, your natural inclination is to say this is damaging to the rock art underneath. It doesn't often look like an embellishment.
No, it doesn't. One of the factors that we began to see is that when you examine the patterned representation of this kind of imagery, much of it is not superimposed on other older rock art images, but appears by itself adjacent to or independent from the older rock art images. So if it was their intention to eradicate or somehow superimpose the rock art, then why would mm-hmm. much of it still be present independent of the older rock art? See, it doesn't make sense.
Sure. Yeah, that you're right. You're right. Okay. And I think one thing against the, I would say against the children hypothesis, and when I say children, I mean children behaving poorly and scratching the rock art when they weren't supposed to. I think you would find that in a lot more circumstances, because it doesn't matter if kids are from 500 years ago, 5 years ago, or 5,000 years ago, they're all going to misbehave the same way and scratch on the rock art. So exactly. you would have an almost ubiquitous exactly. presence of children.
Right. So yeah. when you look at this scratched rock art, one of the things people want to know is, what is it date to, and why do we think it's Nummik and so late? Well,
yeah.
when a lot of us have studied it, examined it very closely, even with a microscope, we believe it's superimposed. Literally, it's overlapping with the older mm-hmm. rock art. So it's almost the last episode of rock art that we can find on the stone canvases that we see the earlier rock art represented.
Interesting.
And then we also find another kind of rock art that has to do with incised stones. These are these little, mm-hmm. they're pieces of stone that are also scratched, and they also are abstract, and they're mobile. You can pick them up and move them around. And again, the subject matter is almost exclusively abstract, and also it seems to be an attempt, again, to use this rectilinear, diagonal, crisscross kind mm-hmm. of patterning. But on occasion, they do show feminine figures or even cradle boards or what appears to be you know, women's genitalia on these mobile pieces of rock art.
Yeah, I would say it's crazy that that's come back around for me, because I have a friend who studied these incised stones for his PhD work probably, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, give or take. And he was studying that of California. So, yeah.
Okay. And what did he think they were?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to read his dissertation. I remember him presenting it in SAA's, or maybe it was an SCA, Society for California Archaeology meeting. But it would be interesting to maybe get him back on here and talk about what some of his findings were. I think he's doing, CRM work in the California right now. So I'd have to see what his thoughts are on that then and now. So yeah, maybe we can get him on.
One of the things that we talk about was doing this diagonal work or the scratching. Mm-hmm. Well, if we look at the embellishments on the cradle boards of babies, the gender of the baby is represented by these diagonal lines that are embellishing the cradle boards. In other words, there's a male child or a female child, and both of those are represented in almost an identical design set as you see on the Nummik rock art. Hmm. Which is interesting. Okay. Yeah, so you've got the Nummik infant cradle boards that have those hoods and sunshades, but also they have this design on them that you see mimicked by the parallel lines that occur and the crisscrosses that occur on the Nummik rock art.
Okay. All right, well, let's take this opportunity to take a final break here. And then when we come back, I want to talk about some other things related to this Nummik scratched rock art. And particularly, I want to talk about some dating methods around this stuff and how we know what we know about it. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the third and final segment of episode 32 of the Rock Art Podcast, and I'm talking with Dr. Alan Garfinkel about Nummik scratched rock art. So, Alan, you've mentioned a few times here, you know, we're tying this to the Nummik people, if you will, and we know some things about some of the designs and stuff, but how do we know, you've actually kind of glossed over dating too, but how do we know a little more specifically around what this rock art dates to, or how specific can we even get?
Well, those are great questions, and for a variety of reasons, I can sort of answer them, believe it or not, which in rock art is no easy task. Our friend Amy Gilreath, who has done a lot of work in the COSOs, recorded tons of this Nummik scratched rock art up in the Pinyon Zone, and she did an analysis and published a paper on the correlation of these sites with very late single component sites. So what we find is desert side notch and cottonwood triangular projectile points occurring in great ubiquity and even sometimes exclusively with this rock art. We find little to no repatination, so it's obviously recent. And it is superimposed over the older, more ancient images. And it appears to be the most recent episode of rock art production. So all of those factors sort of come together to argue for a very late and recent age for that reason alone, which is rather interesting, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, because we said we're going to talk about women, what does this rock art mean? And for Joanne Van Tilburg and other scholars, women scholars that are involved in the study of rock art, they believe that some of this activity was related to sort of thoughts or urges for childbearing, femininity, propitiation, prayer, abundance, prophecy, fertility, women's concerns that women would have about the world, and about their role as a woman in native culture, if that makes any sense as well. And they find this rock art in plant gathering areas, pinyon zones, riparian areas, pottery production areas, areas they would be collecting a material for basketry, exactly where women would conduct subsistence activities or a traditional workspace.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this really wasn't my idea. This was something that's sort of been in the literature for a while. And it seems like a number of women themselves have begun to, you know, sort of toss this idea around and see if it has indeed has validity. If you think about it, some of the other data sets that seem to support that particular interpretive platform, mm-hmm. you find this gnomic rock art incised on pottery. And wow. we believe that women were making the pottery. It's also incised on pendants. It's scratched on milling features and bedrock milling features in that way. Also, when you do see any of these naturalistic depictions, which are rare, mm-hmm. some people have interpreted them as depictions of homes, plants, leaves, baskets, and trees. These seem to be feminine classifications of subject matter. Also, we see this these same design elements, motifs on weaving, on textiles, on basketry. They're found on what they call scratching sticks or baby rattles. These are feminine symbols that they're also found on cradle boards and sunshades. There's almost a package of information that seems to sort of move around the nature of gender and perhaps an understanding of womanly concerns. Does that make any sense? Hmm.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. There's a lot of, well, there's a lot of talk about that in the archaeological record and interpretations. And it's become an
issue for anthropology and archaeology to try to begin to bring in women and begin to understand women's roles in traditional cultures because they've been somewhat invisible. Am I correct or no?
Well, I think maybe, but that's where some studies are starting to change a little bit, right? And they're starting to realize that, and I wish I had some of the evidence around this at hand, but I have heard some rumblings lately about, you know, well, maybe women were just doing these things and men were just doing these things. And it wasn't this strict division of labor and responsibilities, but women were actually hunting and men were doing a little bit of hunting and gathering. And it was more of a mixture between the two.
Yeah. Bill Hildebrand and Kelly McGuire did a famous article in the Journal of California yeah. Great Basin Anthropology about women's roles in the middle, in sort of the milling stone horizon, and saying mm-hmm. that there might have been gender different, you know, that the gender roles are very different. And one thing to sort of throw into the mix here, it's possible, I don't know if it's probable, but it has been reported that mm-hmm. contemporary Nnamdi women have been in situations up in the pinyin zone, revisiting their ancestral locations in situations mm-hmm. where the incising of rocks continues to take place. So in other words, they pick up a piece of obsidian and begin to fashion these same images. And we have personal communications from some prominent archaeologists that have seen this occur. And they assert that Native Indian women of Nnamdi heritage having ancestral ties to the landscape that they visited, incised on rocks with small obsidian flakes. And this was part of their tradition, part of the things they do.
Well, that's good. And that's actually a good segue into something I was thinking about, because we have some, I would say, pretty well-documented ethnographic histories from, you know, European-based settlers into the West, looking at and writing about Native American cultures over here. Do we have pretty good solid evidence of this sexual division of labor as observed by those early visitors?
Well, I think we do. The ethnologists uniformly, you know, can agree on that the division of labor is for foragers, for hunter-gatherers, are pretty descriptive and pretty consistent historically and over contemporary times. But we certainly don't know if we peer back into the past in hundreds of years and even thousands of years, whether those roles were more malleable, more flexible, what have you. I want to note you were mentioning about bringing in some other interesting examples from the old world. And you may not have heard this, but, you know, we have a means now of developing gender confidently, examining the imprints of individuals' hands on rock art. You're aware of that, aren't you?
Well, I know in pictographs, individuals' hands, but are you meaning like handedness in the scratching and creation of rock art?
No. I mean they've gone back and examined some of the earliest rock art that often has multiple expressions of people's hands, either by putting them in pigment or blowing the pigment around the hand and getting a positive image. And they've examined, you know, quite a large inventory of these hands. And what they found was they're women's hands. They're young women, not men, but young women.
Wow.
And this was in the old world, dealing with rock art that's tens of thousands of years old.
Wow, that's awesome. Yeah, I know there's definitely the famous Lascaux Caves has those handprints. Yeah, that's awesome.
So for those who are looking for the place and role of women in rock art, I guess we can say there's growing evidence that, in fact, in some way or other, they appear to have participated. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean, that seems pretty clear. Yeah. One of the final things about this topic in this episode that I wanted to cover is, you know, we spend a lot of time because you and I both have done a lot of work down in, you know, California, the Great Basin, the Eastern Mojave, those areas. So a lot of our discussion tends to take place down there. But when we were talking about this show before we hit record, we were talking about Nummic scratched, you know, we call it Nummic scratched here, but this style of scratched rock art, is this visible in other places of the world, in other areas around that you're aware of?
Oh, absolutely. There's scratched art, rock art throughout the world. It's especially present in the American Southwest. And certainly it may be of different age and of different ethnic affiliation wherever it occurs. So I'm certainly not stating or even trying to present a working hypothesis that this particular expression of rock art, geographically restricted and ethnically tied and gendered, can be transferred or can be used as some sort of a working model or hypothesis for other scratch rock art. Because scratch rock art can occur as old, very ancient. It can also occur very recently. It can occur in many different measures all throughout the world. Alexander Marshak was a famous rock art scholar of some sort, and he analyzed the oldest rock art that appeared on these portable rock slates or tablets. And he tried to argue that the scratched rock art that is associated with these, you know, tens of thousands of year old artifacts are in fact numerical or have to do with archaeoastronomy and the tallying of the movements of the stars, the moon, and the sun.
Really? Okay. That's interesting. I'm always interested in things that purport to tally something like that, because I've heard that about other types of rock art as well, but it seems like kind of a one-off event, right? Like you're going to tally like every time the sun hits the equinox one way or the other, whichever equinox you're talking about, or, you know, the moon, you know, is full versus new moon or something like that.
Yeah.
But that seems like kind of a one-off, right? Unless you're just doing it over and over and over again in different places, which is why we would end up with this scratch representation in a lot of different places in the same locality, I guess.
Well, when I've seen this tallying go on, and I have spoken with the one of the foremost researchers on this very subject about tallies and rock art, and looking at the way in which to understand it. That was Ed Krupp from the Griffith Park Observatory, who was one of the pioneers and developers of the field of archaeoastronomy. He said that some of these tallies are lunations. And if they were involved with individuals that were, in fact, following the movements of the moon or the sun and recording them on the rocks.
Okay.
And when you go back to ethnography, and I found that there's descriptions of the new moon and when a prominent elder would ask the kids, says, this is a new moon. The moon is gone. I want you all to run around and bring back the moon. And they would have a ceremony of the new moon to induce it to come back.
Wow.
This was amongst the Luiseno, there's a very famous ethnography of sorts, a religious tract that was done by a Franciscan father, Father Boscana, who describes the Luiseno and their religious tradition called Chinichnich, which is the name of their religious god. And it had to do with the movements of the cosmos in part.
Wow. On that note, that's really great. I like taking kind of a deep dive into this one style. Do you have any final thoughts or anything you want to leave our listeners with regarding Nummik Scratched?
Well, if anybody goes out and looks at rock art throughout the Desert West, take a look and see if you see any of it and shoot me an email with a picture. I would love to hear more about your discoveries. Mm-hmm. It's not easy to find, but it's all over. And it would be interesting to me to see it. It sings my spirit when people send me images of things I haven't seen before. And it makes you ponder and it sort of broadens your horizon. So I think I'll stop with that.
And I think to either help bolster or refute the child hypothesis, send us pictures of your kids drawing on the walls of their bedrooms as well. When they get the crayons, or when they get the chalk outside, let's see what those look like.
Yeah, we'll compare and contrast. That we'll do a participatory anthropology. How's that?
That's right. Experimental participatory. Right,
exactly. The replicative experiment. So thank you all for listening. I've gotten a lot of wonderful feedback on these podcasts, and I hope you all continue to listen, and I hope you are educated and inspired and enjoy our discussions.
Yeah. And one final note here. I'm, co-hosting this episode right now and producing it, but I'm also the founder of the Archaeology Podcast Network. And we are having a huge push here in 2021 for membership. So if you're interested in supporting what we do, we're trying to increase the number of things we offer. But aside from the few things that you can get, including early episodes and commercial free episodes, and the ability to chat with our hosts and other members on a private members only Slack team, we've got some other stuff coming on down the line. But that and, it's, I think, $7.99 a month or something like that to just support what we're doing and keep this all going. So a lot of us do this just in our spare time. And there's a lot of episodes. There's other stuff on the APN that you can find. We have over, I think, about 20 to 25 podcast downloads, podcast episodes released every month, some weekly shows, some biweekly shows, and some monthly shows. So go over there to arcpodnet.com, find what you like. And if you like what you hear and you want to support us, arcpodnet.com/members. And as you heard at the beginning of this show, go over to the California Rock Art Foundation and support them as well, because archaeology is not the kind of thing industry wants to pay for. So we rely on donors and people with, good hearts and a zest for learning history to support our efforts. So head over to the California Rock Art Foundation and check out arcpodnet.com/members. Thanks everybody for listening. And thank you, Alan. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. You can find this podcast on the educational podcast app Lyceum, Lyceum, and wherever you find podcasts. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.